The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why My Lowe's Rewards members get a free paint or exterior stain sample to test your look and find the perfect color to confidently refresh your space. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid in-store only 6/19 through 6/25. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See associate for details. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon.
Could you please introduce yourself to the jury and spell your last name for the court?
Certainly. My name is Hannah Knowles. My last name is spelled K-N-O-W-L-E-S.
And what is your occupation?
I'm a forensic scientist at the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab.
And prior to working at the lab, where did you go to school?
I have a Bachelor of Science from Simmons University in Boston and a Master's of Science in Forensic Science from the George Washington University.
And how long have you worked at the State Police Lab?
Since October of 2006.
And in what capacity do you work there now?
I'm currently a Forensic Scientist 4 in the Toxicology Unit.
Now, when you joined the State Police Lab, what was your position and title that you were initially hired for?
I was initially hired as a Chemist 1 in the Drug Identification or Narcotics Unit. After about a year in that position, I was promoted to a Chemist 2 position. After about a year, there was a position available in the Toxicology Unit, so I applied for that available position. Transferred to the tox unit in about August of 2007 and have been in the toxicology unit ever since.
And Ms. Knowles, briefly, if you could describe sort of what is the difference between a Chemist 1 and a Chemist 2?
At the time, the job series for folks that worked at the crime lab was the Chemist series. A Chemist 1 was an entry-level or trainee-type position where the individual was responsible for progressing through the training program, assisting with casework as they are authorized on different modules. A Chemist 2 was a bench-level analyst, someone who had completed training or had a significant amount of authorizations and could work on casework and worked independently from that point forward.
And similarly, what is sort of the difference between a Chemist 2 and a Chemist 3?
The Chemist 3 series that was in place prior to 2014 was a first-level supervisory role. It was somebody who oversaw the day-to-day operations and the work of Forensic Scientists 1 and 2, or Chemists 1 and 2.
And what are your current duties and responsibilities at the State Police Lab?
In 2014, those chemist classifications that I was describing got changed to forensic scientists. Forensic scientists 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 is the series. Currently, I'm a forensic scientist 4, and so my role is overseeing training and validation for the toxicology unit.
Is there a continuing educational component to your work at the lab?
Yes, there is.
And can you describe that for the jury, please?
As part of our accreditation, analysts are required to participate in continuing education at least once per year as they continue to work in their role. Continuing education can consist of participating in workshops or webinars, attending conferences or meetings, or documenting ongoing literature review of new journal articles as they're published.
What is proficiency testing?
Proficiency testing is something that we utilize in the laboratory to assess processes and competencies of an individual, as well as the processes that are in place for a particular unit or department or scope of testing. Proficiency testing is also an accreditation requirement. Individuals are required by our internal processes to participate in proficiency testing at least once per year as sort of an ongoing assessment. And what a proficiency test is materials that are purchased by the laboratory from a third-party vendor. Those materials are analyzed as if they were casework, but there are expected results or known results for those samples. Once the laboratory processes those samples, just like their casework, we submit the results to the external vendor that we purchased the materials from. The results are compared to the expected results, and we have to have our results meet those expected results in order for the proficiency test to be considered successful.
Now, over the course of your years at the lab, have you undergone proficiency testing?
Yes, I have.
And have you passed each of those respective proficiency tests that you've taken?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
Now, is the State Police Lab accredited?
Yes, it is.
And by whom?
The Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab is currently accredited by the American National Standards Institute National Accreditation Board.
And what does that accreditation process consist of?
The accreditation process consists of on-site assessments as well as remote or virtual assessments to evaluate our policies and procedures, our personnel, our management, as well as our facilities to ensure that we are meeting established accreditation standards. The standards that we're currently accredited to is an international standard 17025 with additional requirements for forensic testing laboratories. And so there are folks that come from that organization, ANAB, that come to evaluate all of those different aspects of our processes to ensure that we are meeting the standards set out in their requirements.
And the State Police Lab, in particular, the toxicology unit within that lab, is that accreditation up to date at this point?
Yes, we're currently accredited to that standard.
Now, just in general terms, Ms. Knowles, if you could explain to the jury, what is forensic science?
Forensic science generally is the application of science to questions of law.
And just again, in sort of general terms, if you could explain to the jury, what is toxicology?
Toxicology generally is a study of chemicals and other substances and how they impact a living organism or a person.
Now, asking a little more specifically, what is forensic toxicology?
Forensic toxicology is generally looking at drugs and alcohol in the human body and how it affects the individual, and applying chemistry and other disciplines to measure the concentration or determine the presence or absence of relevant substances.
Are there different types of alcohol?
Yes, there are.
Okay. And what are those types?
Generally, alcohols are a family or a group of drugs or chemicals that have a specific functional group or a specific structure. The types of alcohols that are analyzed in the laboratory that I work include methanol, ethanol, and isopropanol.
And what are the differences between those different types?
They all have similar but slightly different structures. Methanol is a solvent. Sometimes it's called wood grain alcohol. Isopropanol is rubbing alcohol, or 2-propanol, and that is typically used as a disinfectant. And ethanol is the type of alcohol that we typically are referring to when we talk about alcoholic beverages. It's what's present in those types of liquids.
Now, Ms. Knowles, through your training and experience, are you familiar with the term known as a central nervous system depressant?
Yes, I am.
And can you explain that term to the jury?
Sure. A central nervous system depressant is a drug or a substance that works to slow down the reactions of nerves in your body. So it makes nerve cells slower or less likely to respond to stimulus.
Now, is alcohol a central nervous system depressant?
Yes, it is.
And how would that central nervous system depressant affect the human body?
The effects depend on the concentration or the amount that's present in the body. Effects range, depending on that concentration, from slowing reaction time, reducing heart rate or respiration rate in an individual. That slower respiration rate can also result in drowsiness or unconsciousness. Slower reaction time and more limited muscle control can also result in outward appearances like a staggering gait or slurred speech. It can impair balance and motor coordination. Because nerves are responding more slowly, alcohol can also, or ethanol specifically, can impact your brain's ability to form new memories. It can impact your body's ability to perceive and apply critical thinking. Again, all of those effects that I just described, they can be present depending on the concentration and the individual and how they're responding to that particular concentration of ethanol at any particular time.
Now, how is work assigned within the State Police Lab, specifically within the Toxicology Unit?
Generally, supervisors will come up with a monthly schedule or rotation where the different types of work in the unit are divided amongst authorized analysts. And then casework is assigned according to that rotation. If an individual has previously been assigned work for that case or has previously issued a report for that case, then sometimes we go off rotation and assign a case according to that previous involvement or previous report that was issued for the case.
Now, at some point, were you assigned to perform some work on a lab case number 22-06576 pertaining to this defendant, Karen Reed?
Yes, I was.
And what is it that you were asked to do?
I was asked to prepare a serum conversion report and a retrograde extrapolation report relative to this case.
Now, how many serum conversions have you conducted during your years at the lab?
I've prepared over 100 serum conversion reports since I was authorized in 2008.
And how many retrograde analyses have you conducted during your years at the lab?
I would say approximately 15.
Now, starting with a serum conversion, can you please explain to the jury what a serum conversion is and how it is that it's conducted?
Certainly. A serum conversion is a service that the laboratory offers when a blood or a serum ethanol concentration has been determined, and it would be helpful or relevant for us to approximate what a corresponding whole blood alcohol concentration would be. When we're talking about blood alcohol concentrations or blood ethanol concentrations and serum ethanol concentrations, serum ethanol concentrations are always higher than a blood alcohol concentration. If you had a blood and a serum sample that were collected from the same person at the same time, you would always expect the serum alcohol to be between 13 and 19% higher than the whole blood. So for that reason, that difference between the two, this service that we offer can assist to approximate what a corresponding whole blood ethanol concentration would be based on testing on a serum ethanol concentration.
And did you have occasion to perform a serum conversion with respect to this defendant?
Yes, I did.
And what materials or documents did you receive in order to perform that analysis?
For the serum conversion, I referred to medical records that were provided with the request.
I may approach and retrieve what's been previously marked as Exhibit 37.
Yes.
May I approach the witness?
Yes.
I'm showing you a document. Do you recognize that document? May I approach again, Your Honor?
Yes. Yes. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Turning your attention to a previously tabbed portion of those records. It's the 52nd page of those records. Do you recognize that?
Yes. The flagged page is consistent with the portion of the medical records that I had reviewed in preparation for doing the serum conversion calculations for this report.
And those medical records pertain to a Ms. Karen Reed from the Good Samaritan Medical Center, is that correct?
Yes, they do.
Okay. And in those records on that 52nd page, what was reported as the defendant's ethanol level?
The results are recorded as an alcohol result with a value of 93 milligrams per deciliter.
And pursuant to those records, at what time was that sample taken from the defendant at the Good Samaritan Medical Center?
The collection time listed on the medical records is January 29th, 2022 at 9:08 a.m.
Now, that recording and a measurement of milligrams per deciliter, is that typical for how you see ethanol measured by hospital labs?
Yes.
And did you conduct the serum conversion for this defendant's reading consistently with how you do in every case that's assigned to you?
Yes.
Now, please explain to the jury how you're able to convert that serum level reading to a blood alcohol concentration.
So the way that the calculation is performed is kind of in two steps. So the results are listed in milligrams per deciliter, which is common in clinical testing. And to convert it to the type of units that are typically used for blood alcohol concentrations, we just divide by 1,000 to get that into the right units. So 93 milligrams per deciliter converts to 0.093 grams per cent. And then to perform the serum conversion, or to get this serum ethanol concentration into what we would estimate to be a blood alcohol concentration, we apply two conversion factors, a low and a high conversion factor, to account for the range that we see in the typical population. I'd mentioned earlier that serum is usually between 13 to 19% higher, so we divide that 0.093 by 1.13 and by 1.19 to get a low and a high blood alcohol concentration for that range.
And those conversion factors that you just mentioned, where do those come from?
The conversion factors come from literature, where they've performed experiments similar to how I described. They have individuals that have ingested ethanol. They collect samples from them and test their whole blood and test their serum alcohol concentrations, and then compare them and see what the ratio is between them. The current ratios that are used by the laboratory, the 13 and 19%, those are also consistent with consensus body documents, or sort of industry standards that we utilize and base our protocols upon.
Now, that 13 and 19%, how long have those conversion factors been in place?
There was a consensus body document published in 2024, and so we adjusted the serum conversion factors that had previously been in use to those new published, or those new recommendations, in September of 2024.
Now, does the change in conversion factors recently adopted by your lab, does that benefit the patient or the person for whom you're converting the ethanol to a blood alcohol concentration?
Objection.
I'll allow it. Does it?
Yeah, the previous factors were we used between 12% and 18%. And so when you perform that conversion, it typically ends up with a equivalent or lower blood alcohol concentration. And so it could be interpreted as being favorable to a defendant.
Now, why are they presented in a range?
We don't use just one conversion factor because in the studies that we base our procedures on, it demonstrates that the general population does not have one consistent conversion factor or ratio between their whole blood and their serum alcohol concentrations. And so to ensure that the conversion that we're utilizing applies to most of the general population, we use sort of the extremes of what we see in that literature, like a high and a low, to make sure that our approximation falls, that the true value would fall somewhere in between that low and that high value.
And what did you calculate as a low and a high range for this defendant's blood alcohol concentration from that alcohol reading from the Good Samaritan Medical Center?
So the 93 milligrams per deciliter serum ethanol concentration would convert to between 0.078 and 0.092% or grams percent.
And again, Ms. Knowles, that's at the time that the blood is drawn at approximately 9:08 a.m. on January 29th. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, turning your attention to retrograde extrapolation, can you explain to the jury what a retrograde extrapolation is?
Sure. A retrograde extrapolation is another service that the laboratory offers where it's a calculation that we can perform when we have a alcohol concentration that was measured at a particular time, and it would be helpful or relevant to know what that person's blood alcohol concentration was at some point prior to that sample having been collected. What we're doing with this calculation is taking what we know about how quickly the human body is capable of breaking down alcohol and applying that rate of elimination to the time interval between when the sample was collected and tested and when there might be a particular time of interest, a car accident or some interaction where that person's blood alcohol concentration might be relevant.
And how is that done?
Similar to the range of conversion factors that we were looking at with the serum conversion, we know that the rate of elimination in alcohol in humans varies from person to person. And so based on studies where they're looking at rates of elimination in large groups of people, we know that alcohol can break down at a rate of between 0.010 and 0.025% per hour. And so we take the, when we're looking at a serum conversion and then being combined with a retrograde, we take the smaller of the serum conversion range and we add that to the slowest elimination rate multiplied by a time interval. And then we also take the larger of the serum conversion values, and then we add that to the fastest elimination rate multiplied by the time interval. We use a smaller time interval for that sort of minimum calculation to account for the fact that we don't want to overshoot that estimate of blood alcohol concentration if there was some unabsorbed alcohol. We don't necessarily always know when we perform these calculations the drinking history or like when the person had stopped drinking that day. And so we usually subtract 2 hours from the time interval when we're doing that minimum calculation to have a more conservative estimate. So we're applying the time interval, the rates of elimination, and looking at what we have for blood alcohol concentrations, all to be considered when we're performing the calculation.
Now, what categories of information do you need in order to perform a retrograde analysis?
We need to know what the blood alcohol concentration was at the time that the sample was collected. We need to know the time the sample was collected, and we need to know the incident time or the time of interest that we're sort of calculating back to. There's a couple of requirements to be able to perform this calculation that we have to ensure. We have to make sure that there's at least been 2 hours in that time interval between the time of collection and the time of interest that we're looking at. We can't calculate backwards with that very narrow window because we can't be sure that the person is entirely in the elimination phase, that their body has reached a maximum blood alcohol concentration and they're just breaking down alcohol at that point. And we also know that this simple rate of elimination calculation can't be accurately modeled once we get down below between 0.02 and 0.03. So we have to make sure that the starting blood alcohol concentration is at least an 0.03 or higher in order to be able to apply that math.
Now, how is it that alcohol is metabolized within the body?
Generally, after someone stops drinking alcohol, their body reaches a maximum blood alcohol concentration. And then after that maximum is reached, for most folks, that's between 30 and 90 minutes after they stop drinking. And then the body breaks the alcohol down over time in a very predictable linear fashion. Down until it gets down into about 0.02 and 0.03. The mechanism that the body uses to metabolize, some alcohol is excreted in urine, some alcohol is evaporated and removed from the body through your breath, but the vast majority is broken down with enzymes in your body that convert the ethanol structure into water and carbon dioxide.
What are the phases of metabolism for alcohol in the body?
So alcohol, once it's ingested, moves through the body in a couple of different phases. One, initially, the body is absorbing alcohol. Then the alcohol is distributed throughout the body where it can have its effects. There's the metabolism phase and then elimination. Most drugs and alcohol all kind of follow that same pattern in these different phases. And so I'd mentioned elimination phase earlier. That's after you've reached a maximum blood alcohol concentration and your body is no longer absorbing. It's fully distributed in your body, and then you're just breaking it down and removing, your body's removing the alcohol or the ethanol from your system.
Now, in a retrograde analysis, are you calculating for a single number or something else?
So, because we don't know an individual's particular rate of elimination, we use a maximum and a minimum, a fast and a slow elimination rate. And so our results for this calculation are always expressed in a range to ensure that that individual's actual blood alcohol concentration lies somewhere between the range that we provide.
And can you please explain sort of that range in the size of it for the jury?
The range that's provided as part of these calculations, the size of the range depends on the facts of the case and the amount of time that's passed between the time of the incident and the time of the sample collection. The more time that's elapsed, there's a greater difference between the faster and the slower rates of elimination, the 0.01 per hour and the 0.025 per hour.
And what do those minimum and maximum blood alcohol concentration numbers signify?
They signify the smallest and the largest concentration that could be reasonably expected based on the blood alcohol concentration and the rates of elimination that are being applied in the calculation.
Now, were you able to perform a retrograde analysis from this defendant's alcohol blood testing from the Good Samaritan?
Yes, I was.
And similarly, did you perform that in conformity with how you performed prior retrograde extrapolation analyses in other cases?
Yes, I did.
And what time was utilized in your analysis as the time of vehicle operation or of incident?
12:45 a.m., January 29th, 2022.
And do you know where that time came from?
I believe it was the time specified in the request from the district attorney's office.
And why is time of operation or time of incident important?
Because the time interval that we use in the calculation depends on the starting and the ending point of that calculation. So the time of incident is important because that's what we're basing the math on.
And what was the resulting minimum and maximum numbers that you calculated for the defendant's blood alcohol concentration from her blood testing reading from the Good Samaritan Medical Center?
That based on the 93 milligrams per deciliter value that was obtained at Good Samaritan, that the blood alcohol concentration for that individual at 12:45 a.m. Could be between 0.14 and 0.28 grams per cent.
And so you calculated the defendant's blood alcohol concentration to be between 0.14 and 0.28 at 12:45 a.m. on January 29th, 2022. Is that correct?
Yes.
May I approach just to retrieve, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you, ma'am. I have no further questions.
All right. Ms. Giannetti?
Thank you, Your Honor.
At this point, I'm only going to give you about 5 minutes.
I was going to ask the court to cut me off so that
okay.
Nobody's late today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon.
The Mass State Police Crime Lab you mentioned is an accredited forensic lab, correct?
That's correct.
That means that your lab has met specific internationally recognized standards for both quality and competence, correct?
There are aspects of quality and analyst competence that are addressed in the accreditation standards, yes.
It also means that your lab has demonstrated a commitment to best practices and to ensuring the reliability and accuracy of its forensic work, correct?
Yes.
And there are several requirements in order to become accredited, right?
Yes.
One of the most important requirements is an independent external review of your lab's quality management system, correct?
Yes, that's definitely one important component of the accreditation process.
That independent external review also evaluates your lab's technical systems, correct?
Yes.
And its procedures?
Yes.
And an external review means that experts from outside your lab come into your lab to review your work, right?
Yes, their review includes the procedures and the operating protocols. And there is some element of case file and specific work review.
Within your lab?
Correct.
And they make sure that you're following established and proper protocols, correct?
Yes.
Now, as a forensic scientist is one of your responsibilities to ensure compliance with the lab's administrative policies, quality assurance, and control requirements to make sure that you're complying with accreditation standards?
Yes.
And you take pride in your lab's accreditation status, correct?
Yes, it's an achievement that's obtained by the hard work of a lot of folks at the lab working together.
You make sure, or you do your best to make sure, that the lab is in compliance because you don't want to lose that accreditation status, correct?
Correct. It's important to ensure confidence in our results to maintain the quality and maintain the accreditation.
Okay. In contrast to the accreditation standards for a forensic lab like yours, the standards for a hospital lab may be different, correct?
Correct. Typically, accrediting bodies for clinical chemistry or hospital systems are different accrediting bodies or different standards than forensic standards.
Okay. And a forensic lab exists for a different purpose than a hospital lab. Is that right?
Correct. They have different customers and sort of different scope or intention for the use of their results.
Sure. A hospital lab tests and analyzes blood for its use in diagnosing medical illnesses and for medical purposes, correct?
That's consistent with my understanding, yes.
Sure, and it's not for meeting court admissibility standards like your lab, right?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Your lab follows strict procedures that an expert from your lab can have confidence in the lab results when they come to testify in court like you're doing today, correct?
Yes.
As you testify here today, you have no information that the lab at Good Samaritan Hospital is an accredited lab, correct?
Correct.
And in addition, Good Samaritan Hospital is an external party in terms of its relationship to your lab, right?
Yes, and for that reason, the type of calculations that we performed based on medical records from Good Samaritan are outside of the scope of accreditation in the crime laboratory system.
Right. It has no relationship to your crime lab, the Good Samaritan lab, right?
Correct. The same policies and procedures are applied when our laboratory analyzes serum or if we needed to do a retrograde extrapolation on testing that was performed internally that's covered by the scope of accreditation. But as you're mentioning, the testing was not performed in my laboratory. I don't have any direct knowledge or understanding of their QC procedures, of their accreditation requirements, or their testing procedures at all.
You anticipated my next question. So basically, you cannot personally vouch for the ethanol testing that was performed at Good Samaritan, correct?
That's accurate. The reliability of the results that my calculations were based on, my calculations are only as good as the numbers that I was provided. And like I said, the same math that I did here, I would do to my own internal standard or my own internal testing, anything that I performed testing on in the lab myself. But the results that I started from, I don't have any direct knowledge on their accuracy or reliability.
Right, Ms. Giannetti, we can bring Ms. Knowles back on Monday if you want. I don't want to cut you short. That was the time frame we were looking at.
And I'm perfectly fine with that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Giannetti.
Good morning, Ms. Knowles.
Good morning.
Ma'am, on Friday, you testified to this jury about the fact that the Mass State Police Crime Lab is accredited as a forensic lab, correct?
Yes, I did.
And you discussed the fact that as a forensic chemist four, you help to ensure compliance with the lab's administrative policies, quality assurance, and control requirements, and making sure that you're complying with accreditation standards, correct?
Yes, that's one of my job duties and responsibilities.
You also acknowledge that in contrast to the accreditation standards of your forensic lab, the standards of a hospital lab may be different, correct?
I have no direct knowledge of what the standards at a hospital are, and so I can't say whether they're the same or if they're different. I'm just unfamiliar with them.
Okay. And you're unfamiliar with the standards at Good Samaritan Hospital, correct?
Correct. I have no direct knowledge of their accreditation status or requirements or body.
And you know that they were the ones to do the blood draw in this case, correct?
That's consistent with the medical records I had available for review prior to preparing my report.
And you cannot vouch for that ethanol testing, correct?
Correct. I have no direct knowledge of the accuracy or reliability. My calculations are solely based on the results of the Good Samaritan lab.
For instance, you don't know how the arm was prepared when the blood was drawn?
Correct. I was not present, and I have no knowledge of the policies and procedures of blood draw at Good Samaritan Hospital, nor this case specifically.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. excuse me. You can't vouch for the tubes and vials that Good Samaritan uses?
Correct. I cannot.
Are you aware that there was a recall on certain tubes and vials because there was a contamination determined by the manufacturer?
Sustained.
You can't vouch for how Good Samaritan stores, preserves, and assures the integrity of its equipment, correct?
Correct. I have no direct knowledge of those topics.
Now, excuse me. At your lab, you do both a screening test and a confirmatory test, correct?
Yes, that's accurate.
The confirmatory test is a second and separate test. You rerun the same sample again, correct?
Depending on the type of samples that are submitted and the facts of the case, we will either use the same sample that screened positive or that sample as well as another to run duplicate analysis and compare them. It depends on the materials available and the nature of the case.
Understood. So you do that to ensure that there's no error in the testing, correct?
It's part of many of the steps involved to ensure accuracy and reliability of the results that are reported.
And you realize that when you're doing this testing, because you're a forensic lab, you may ultimately be testifying in court, and you want to make sure you get it right, correct?
Yes.
And the confirmatory test acts as a fail-safe against false positives, for example.
Correct. The screening and the confirmatory test are typically using different methodologies or different techniques to ensure that a false positive under one technique would not have similar issues with the confirmatory technique.
Okay. In this case, your lab did not do any confirmatory testing, correct?
My lab did not have samples submitted for this individual to perform testing on.
You know of no confirmatory testing that was done by Good Samaritan, correct?
I don't know what their policies and procedures are and if the results on the report were the results of confirmatory testing or otherwise.
You just had to assume the accuracy of the testing that they did do, correct?
I used the results that were reported on the medical records provided to perform calculations.
And you cannot testify that the testing done at Good Samaritan meets your accreditation standards, correct?
Correct.
Now, your lab does whole blood testing, does it not?
If whole blood is submitted for a case, then we will test whole blood. If serum or plasma is the only available sample appropriate for testing, then we will proceed with testing on serum or plasma.
Whole blood testing leads to more accurate readings of the percentage of alcohol in somebody's blood, correct?
Correct. If you would like to know the percentage of alcohol in someone's blood, the best sample to test would be their blood.
And you've learned through your training and experience that many hospitals, including Good Samaritan, use a different method of testing than whole blood testing, correct?
Yes.
Good Samaritan uses serum or plasma testing as opposed to whole blood testing.
I'm not familiar with their specific technique or methodology. I haven't undergone training for their methods, but it is my understanding that the type of sample used for their method is serum or plasma.
Now, whole blood includes plasma, but it also includes white blood cells, platelets, and red blood cells, correct?
Correct. Typically, we describe serum or plasma as the liquid portion of blood, and the other cellular components that you described typically are removed or separated before testing.
Plasma has a higher water content than red blood cells, white blood cells, or platelets, right?
Yes, it is.
Alcohol is highly soluble in water, is it not?
Yes.
So alcohol has a better affinity with water. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
That means that alcohol prefers to distribute into the more watery components of blood, correct?
Yes, that's accurate.
And that also means that alcohol is found in higher concentrations in serum and plasma testing than in whole blood testing, correct?
That's correct. That difference in water content is the basis of the serum conversion that I described on Friday.
Okay. So a lab like Good Samaritan's, that in this case did serum or plasma testing, will therefore provide results of blood alcohol concentration that are higher than what the true blood alcohol concentrations are, correct?
The serum alcohol or plasma alcohol concentrations that they report on their medical records would be higher than the corresponding blood alcohol concentration. That's correct.
So to translate the Good Samaritan results into a more accurate reading of blood alcohol content, you need to convert the serum and plasma results to what those results would be in whole blood testing, correct?
Yes.
I'll allow it. Can you answer it as stated?
Yes. The accuracy of the value isn't changed by the reading. It's a different value. It's a serum or plasma alcohol concentration versus an estimated blood alcohol concentration. So if it is helpful or relevant to know what the whole blood analysis would have been if the testing had been performed on whole blood, then that conversion, starting with the serum alcohol or plasma alcohol concentration, is helpful to do.
But to calculate a precise conversion rate, you'd first need to know precisely the amount of water in somebody's blood, correct?
The range of serum factors or serum conversion factors that are used in the preparation of my report and the calculations that I performed accounts for total body water variation from individual to individual. The reason I use between 13 and 19% and not just one single value is because I don't know the specific conversion factor that would be appropriate for an individual when I have medical records to review.
I think that was a long way of saying yes to my question, right? My question was to calculate a precise conversion rate for somebody, you'd first need to precisely know the amount of water in that person's blood, correct?
Sustained. Ask it differently, Mr. Unity.
Is it scientifically possible to predict with accuracy a precise conversion rate for one individual person?
Yes.
Everybody has a different amount of water in his or her blood, correct?
There is a normal variation between individuals.
I'm going to do my best to ask yes or no questions, and then if there's an explanation, Mr. Lally can stand up afterward and have you explain, but
so
this will go more quickly.
No comments. Just go ahead and ask a question.
Sure. Everybody has a different amount of water in his or her blood, correct?
Yes.
And there are a number of factors that influence the amount of water in somebody's blood, correct?
Yes.
What is hematocrit?
I don't know.
Hematocrit is the percentage of red blood cells in whole blood cells. Do you know that?
Sustained.
Are you aware that individual hematocrit can vary and that it affects the water content in blood?
Sustained.
Would somebody's age be a factor in determining the amount of water in their blood?
I don't know.
Could somebody's gender affect the amount of water in their blood?
Yes.
Could when somebody had eaten and what somebody had eaten before the blood was drawn affect the amount of water in their blood?
It's possible, but I'm not aware of those factors being considered when performing total body water calculations.
Would how frequently a person uses the restroom affect the amount of water in their blood?
As it would relate to their state of hydration, it's possible, but again, I'm not familiar with performing precise calculations on individuals. It's not a routine part of my job, and it's not in the scope of my expertise.
Would some medications potentially affect the amount of water in somebody's blood?
It's possible, yes.
And conversion factors vary significantly between individuals, but they can also vary within the same individual over time, can they not?
I believe so, yes.
And all of the factors that we've discussed that you've adopted can impact the conversion factor that is used, correct?
Yes.
And there is no one universally agreed upon conversion factor, correct?
Correct. There is a range that is agreed upon, but not a singular conversion factor.
Right. And the range that you used was 1.13 to 1.19, correct?
Yes.
You recognize, however, that with all the factors affecting the amount of water in somebody's blood from person to person, and even within one person over time, some people can fall outside the range that you used, correct?
Yes.
And you recognize that some studies have shown a conversion rate from serum to whole blood can be higher than 1.19, correct?
Yes.
Are you aware of a study by Rainey, R-A-I-N-E-Y, reporting conversion rates as high as 1.59?
Yes.
And if the conversion rate is higher, that would mean that the actual blood alcohol concentration would be lower, correct?
Yes.
So if you're using a range of conversion factors that does not capture what the conversion factor should be for the individual that you're testing, you can't have confidence in the result, correct?
Correct. The range that is utilized is looking at studies of large groups of people to try to capture as accurately as possible most individuals in the population, but it would not cover 100% of scenarios with all the factors that you've described.
Okay. And you'd agree that your conversion of serum to whole blood here is imprecise, correct?
The conversion was performed within the policies and procedures of the laboratory and the best practice recommendations for my field.
But it is imprecise.
Can you repeat the question?
Let's move on. The conversion from serum to whole blood did not end the calculations that you needed to do in order to testify here today, correct?
Correct.
The conversion from serum to whole blood only translated what Ms. Reed's blood alcohol supposedly would have been, or was, I'm sorry, at the hospital at 9:08 a.m. on January 29th of 2022, correct?
Yes.
You were asked to try to find out what her blood alcohol level would have been 7 or 8 hours earlier, closer to midnight or sometime between midnight and 1 a.m., correct?
The time utilized for my calculations was 12:45 a.m.
So you started with the results that you obtained from your serum to whole blood conversion, right?
Yes.
Which was an imprecise calculation?
Which was intending to cover the majority of population.
But was it imprecise?
It followed the policies and procedures of my laboratory.
What was the precise number then? Was there a precise number or was it imprecise?
The range?
I'm not talking about a range. I know that you'd like to say that. Was there a precise number, ma'am?
The results of my report was not a single number. Okay. It is a range of numbers.
Let's move on, Ms. Giannetti.
Yes. Then once you get that range, you have to do an extrapolation on top of that to figure out what the blood alcohol concentration would have been at 12:45, 7 or 8 hours earlier, correct?
Yes.
But in order to do that extrapolation, you need to make assumptions about things that you do not know, correct?
Yes.
In terms of processing alcohol, there is an absorption phase, a plateau, and an elimination phase, correct?
Yes, that's accurate and consistent with my understanding.
And during the absorption phase, blood alcohol concentration can be rising, correct?
Yes.
And to determine whether somebody is in the absorption phase or the elimination phase, you need to know when their last drink was, correct?
Yes, if you're performing that type of calculation, or if you're trying to determine if they've reached their maximum, that would be helpful information to have.
The longer the time between the last drink and the test, the more variability and potential for error there is in the extrapolation, correct?
Can you ask the question again, please?
In this case, you assumed that Ms. Reed's last drink was at 12:45 a.m., correct?
No. The calculation assumed for the maximum calculation that no alcohol had been consumed between 1.5 and 2 hours prior to that time interval start at 12:45 a.m.
Okay. And the test wasn't until 9:08 a.m.?
Yes.
The range that you came up with was 0.14 to 0.28%, correct?
Yes, 0.14 to 0.28 grams per cent.
And that was a very wide range, was it not?
It certainly is.
0.28 is double 0.14?
Yep.
And that range is so wide because there are a lot of unknowns about the way each person individually processes alcohol, correct?
There's a lot of interpersonal differences, that's correct.
There are a lot of different factors that would impact somebody's blood alcohol content, correct?
Yes.
What somebody had to eat can impact their blood alcohol concentration, correct?
The contents of their stomach or what they had eaten recently does not impact the rates of elimination that I use for my calculation, but it can factor into the absorption part of the curve and can impact that maximum amount that's reached.
Okay. Their body weight can impact their blood alcohol concentration, correct?
Correct. Again, it would not necessarily, or it could be included in the rate of elimination range that I use for my calculations. The person's body weight has more to do with, again, the absorption, the maximum concentration, the first parts of the curve, and not the elimination portion that we're discussing when we're doing retrograde extrapolation.
And the first word of your answer was correct, right?
Yes.
A person's metabolic rate can impact their blood alcohol concentration because different people metabolize alcohol at different rates, correct?
Yes.
In addition, regarding the timing of the last drink, you were not with Ms. Reed on the late evening of January 28th or the early morning of January 29th of 2022, correct?
Correct, I was not.
You have no personal knowledge of when Ms. Reed had her last drink, correct?
Correct.
Were you informed that Ms. Reed was upset after 12:45 a.m.? When you were doing these calculations?
I don't believe so.
Did you know, were you informed, that she went to John O'Keefe's house in Canton and was the only adult in the house at that time after 12:45?
Sustained.
Are you aware of what type of alcohol John O'Keefe had available in his house at that time?
Sustained.
Were you aware that she was waiting for John O'Keefe to come home, but he never did?
Sustained.
Do you have any personal knowledge of whether Ms. Reed poured herself a drink during the hours of 12:45 a.m. and 6 a.m. on January 29th of 2022?
No, I do not.
And do you know whether she had more than one drink during those hours?
No, I do not.
Assume that Ms. Reed did have something alcoholic to drink after 12:45 a.m., would that affect your assumptions about whether she was in the absorption or the elimination phase?
Yes, it would.
And if she did have something to drink after 12:45 a.m., what would that do to your calculations?
The foundation of my calculations would be incorrect. I would need to perform different calculations or factor in the information as it would become available and issue a different report.
Okay. So if your assumption of when she had her last drink was incorrect, you would not have confidence that your conclusions about which you testified Friday and today are accurate, correct?
Correct. There is some parts of the calculation that are intended to accommodate for unknown drinking history, but with a over eight hour time span between the time of interest and the time that the blood sample was collected, that adjustment in the calculation intending to avoid overshooting the blood alcohol concentration may or may not be enough to address that. And if new, more accurate information was available, then I would need to incorporate that in the discussion and calculations.
Right. So in answer to my question, if your assumption about when the last drink was consumed was incorrect, you would not have confidence that your conclusions are accurate today.
Correct.
Now, were you ever asked to determine the blood alcohol level of Brian Albert?
No.
Were you ever asked to determine the blood alcohol level of Brian Higgins?
Sustained.
Were you asked to determine the blood alcohol level of anyone except for Karen Reed in this case?
I'll allow that.
To the best of my knowledge, my only involvement with this case in my unit was the request to perform these calculations on this individual.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Lally.
Good morning, Ms. Knowles.
Good morning.
Now, again, how many serum conversions have you performed over your years at the lab?
It's hard to know an exact number, but at least over 100.
And the ethanol reading or the alcohol reading within Ms. Reed's medical records that you testified to previously last week, what was that reading again?
93 milligrams per deciliter.
And that reading in milligrams per deciliter, is that typical for how you would see alcohol recorded in hospital records?
Yes, it is.
And specifically hospital records that you would then be asked to perform a serum conversion on?
Yes.
Now, with respect to your calculations in this case, did you perform these calculations consistent with how you have done in each and every prior instance within your work at the lab?
Yes, the serum conversion factors have been adjusted since I first started doing these, but the same type of math was performed, and I'd used the approved conversion factors that are published in our protocols with each one that I did.
Now, what is the difference between whole blood and serum?
Whole blood is blood as we think of it with both the liquid and the cellular components as it exists in our bodies. Serum is the liquid portion of blood after those cellular components have been removed.
And how does the difference between them impact your testing or your calculations?
Because of the different water content in whole blood versus serum, that means that if we would like to compare a serum alcohol concentration and a whole blood alcohol concentration, that we have to apply a conversion factor to be able to compare those two. The serum alcohol concentration is always higher than the whole blood alcohol concentration.
And that difference, is that accounted for within the calculations or the conversion factors that you utilize?
Yes.
And how so?
The conversion factors, by dividing by 1.13 and 1.19, can adjust for the difference between the water content and therefore the serum and whole blood ratio that's observed in studies.
And that change in conversion factors, does that benefit the defendant in this case?
Objection.
I'll allow it. Or ask it differently, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. The change in conversion factors recently implemented in your lab and your protocols, who does that benefit?
The question of benefit depends on the context. Speaking to the math, dividing by a larger number means the resulting number would be smaller. So the whole blood alcohol concentration numbers would be smaller when using the current between 13 and 19% factors, as opposed to the previously used between 12 and 18% factors.
Now, these conversion factors, where again do they come from?
The conversion factors come from published studies involving individuals that consumed alcohol, had samples collected from them, and their whole blood and their serum alcohol concentrations were compared. Those conversion factors are present in the protocols in use in the laboratory where I work, and they're also consistent with best practice recommendations or consensus body documents in the field that I work.
Now, you were asked on cross-examination about a number of different factors. Are those factors incorporated within the conversion factors and the published scientific literature supporting those conversion factors?
By basing it on studies with a large number of people, that's the intention, is to capture the interpersonal differences in different factors within that range that's used.
Now, if you know, how much in the elimination phase, as far as bladders are concerned, how much loss of alcohol is concerned in the elimination phase with reference to bladder loss?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? I don't think I understood the
poor question.
Phrase.
Let me rephrase. So you were asked some questions on cross-examination about how frequently someone uses the restroom in the elimination phase, correct?
I believe I was, yes. Okay.
And do you have any idea from your training experience as far as how much alcohol is typically lost by an individual during the elimination phase through the bladder?
Objection.
Do you know that?
I do.
Okay, you can answer it.
Less than 5%. The vast majority of alcohol is eliminated from the body by an enzyme that breaks it down from alcohol into carbon dioxide and water. I can't remember exactly how much is generally eliminated, but I believe it's less than 5% of the total blood alcohol concentration.
Now, you were asked about whether or not the defendant had a drink after 12:45 a.m. Do you have any evidence that the defendant did, in fact, have any alcohol to drink after 12:45 a.m.?
Objection.
Sustained.
If there was a drink at approximately 1 a.m., what kind of impact would that have on your calculations?
It would depend on how much had been consumed. If any alcohol had been consumed, then it would adjust the calculations depending on that information.
And what I'm asking, Ms. Knowles, is if there is a slight differential in the time of incident mm-hmm. or last drink, how much impact would that have on the range that you're able to calculate?
I'm not sure.
Now, you testified as far as the range being on the retrograde analysis being between a 0.14 and a 0.28, correct?
Yes, I did.
Are you aware of what the legal limit is in Massachusetts?
Objection.
Well, I'm going to sustain that, actually.
Why is there such a varying range?
Because there is such variation between individuals with their rates of elimination. The calculation used both a sort of extreme low and extreme high rate of elimination. Because we don't know the individual's rate of elimination, that range is intentionally wide to ensure that the actual blood alcohol concentration lies somewhere between it. It's intending to account for a lot of the factors that we've been discussing. It's intentionally a wide range because there are so many unknown factors, and it was so much time that had elapsed between the time of interest and the time of collection.
And based on your calculations, as far as the 93 milligrams per deciliter, what does that convert to as far as the blood alcohol concentration for the defendant at 9:08 a.m. on January 29th?
93 milligrams per deciliter in serum alcohol concentration would convert to between 0.078 and 0.082 grams per cent.
And from your calculations in your retrograde analysis, what was the range that you were able to calculate for the defendant's blood alcohol concentration at 12:45 a.m. on January 29th?
Between 0.14 and 0.28 grams per cent.
And 0.14, 0.28, and every number in between is higher than 0.08. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Nothing further.
No further questions.
All right, Ms. Knowles, you are all set. Thank you very much.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapist provides specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer.
Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.